Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered the House of Mystery on KXIM 98.3 FM Iowa with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Sav.
Back to the House of Mysteries. Zell Warren, KKNW, 1150 AM, Seattle, Now, we've got a great show for you today, and we've had plenty of historians and people that have written on Dracula and Sherlock Holmes and so many mysteries in history. And now we've got one of the good, or one of the greatest, I should say. It's Les Klinger. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
So Les, now, for yourself, how did this start?
I know the story. I actually do know the story. I've actually thought about it. So, it started when I was in law school. There we go, right away. I should have said that. By day, I'm a lawyer. When I was in law school, back in the dark ages, I got a gift from my girlfriend of a book called The Annotated Sherlock Holmes by William Baring Gould. A wonderful, large, two-volume set. And I was a very good student, but I had a rigid policy that I needed to do recreational reading from 11 p.m. to midnight in order to stay sane during law school. So I started to read that book, and I was hooked. I was hooked in part by the Sherlock Holmes stories, which I have to admit I had not paid any attention to as a kid. I was a science fiction reader. But I was also hooked by the footnotes and the discovery that there was this cult of amateur scholars who had devoted themselves for 70 years to writing about Sherlock Holmes and the Victorian period. And I thought to myself, that was really cool. I wanted to sort of be part of the game. And I started to collect Sherlock Holmes stuff, and I started to read the source, the Baker Street Journal. And, of course, I read all Baring Gould. And I had this little fantasy that someday, maybe when I was really old and retired, I might get to be the person who would update that book. It had come out in 1968, and, you know, someday 50 years down the road, whatever, it was going to need updating. So that's where it stood for a long time. And for the next 30 years, I built a legal career and raised a family and was a collector, but I didn't do any writing. And then one day in the mid-90s, I said to my wife, for one too many times, I think, so what are we doing this weekend? And she said, you know, you have all those books on Sherlock Holmes. Why don't you write something? And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, well, I've written legal articles and things like that. Why not? So I started to write articles. And then I said, you know, maybe I could start this idea of re-annotating the original Sherlock Holmes stories. And so I started playing around with that. And one thing led to another. I started producing a series called the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library that was a whole new annotated version of the stories. And then in 2002, out of the blue, I got a call from a senior editor at W.W. Norton, major publisher out of New York, who said, you know that old Baring Gould book? We want to put out a new edition, and we hear you're the guy to edit it. And it was like, me? You know, I'm a lawyer. I'm not, this is a little hobby of mine. But they said, no, we hear you've already started doing it. So I got to it, put it out, and I was very fortunate. Those books were nominated for a bunch of awards, and I won the Edgar, and I thought to myself, well, obviously I'm God's gift to writers. You know, I should be. Why have I been hiding myself under a bushel for all these years? I should be writing. So I thought about what the next project would be. The next project that came to mind that was sensible was Dracula. I produced an annotated edition of Dracula, and that was really the beginning of my saying, you know, maybe I could be a real writer. And so with the help of friends, started to put together anthologies of different sorts, and have done a lot of annotating since then. I'm now up to something like 30 books or 35 books, something like that. So
that's amazing. A lot of work. Maybe explain to the listeners that don't know, what kind of work and detail goes into annotating?
Well, I usually say what you do is you take a classic text and you sprinkle a bunch of footnotes over it, and you know, then you have an annotated edition. What I'm trying to achieve is kind of like the director's track on a DVD. It's a bonus. It's not essential. These books that I've annotated, whether it's Sherlock Holmes or Dracula or Frankenstein or H.P. Lovecraft or other things, they don't need Klinger to make them popular or successful. These are classics. They've already got big audiences. So my aim is to make the reading experience more enjoyable, to maybe add dimensions to the reading that the reader didn't know were there. And so the footnotes and the introductory essays and the supplementary essays aim to show them different kinds of things about the story, the cultural context, the historical context. Glossary. There's a certain amount of glossary when you're talking about books that are old. Problems. Why did the characters behave this way and do this instead of that? And trying to bring a sense of fun to the reading experience. And at the same time, I always find byways. I mean, the footnotes go off on paths that I didn't even know existed until I sort of got into it, and may explore things that are tangential to the text, but I hope elicit in the reader an expression of, that's pretty cool, or that's really interesting.
Now, do you learn a lot about the story? How do I put this? Is there parts of the story that you were totally unaware of when you actually end up doing your work?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for various reasons. One reason is that, of course, I always try to look and see. I mean, maybe you call it laziness. You know, I want to see what other people have said. So I read a great deal on these topics, on whatever book it is. My most recent books, with the exception of Sandman and Watchmen, they are labeled the new annotated, and that's because there are old annotateds out there. So I read that stuff and want to see what questions previous scholars, previous annotators have examined. But also, part of the process of annotating is reading the text very slowly. One of the things I've sort of built into the process is that my wife and I, my wife Sharon, who's very supportive of this stuff and created the monster in the first place, she and I will proofread the original text. And that requires a sort of speed of reading that makes you thoughtful. So when you slow down and you're not so focused on, you know, what's going to happen next in the story, you start to notice language, phrases, place names, people's names, etc., that you might have sort of sped by before. And so those things will spark questions. It'll be, what's that? And then I have to go do some research and figure it out. And if it's interesting, it'll end up as a footnote.
That's pretty interesting. How much further research do you do on these to find out what might be real and what isn't?
Well, a lot. I mean, the quote real parts of these stories really interests me. One of the things that I always have said about the kind of annotating I do is that I've picked books that are so well done that they are really excellent mirrors of their times. So there is a great deal of real stuff. I always joke that someday someone's going to do the annotated Jacqueline Suzanne, in which there'll be a footnote explaining to a contemporary reader, what does it mean that the character looked at her watch? You know, what's that? A watch?
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. So, I think that there's a great deal of research. One of the things that I mean, when I talk about Sherlock Holmes, I always say, look, my book stood on the shoulder of William Baring-Gould, and I had three great advantages that he didn't have. Number one, I have a computer, and that means that I can use the internet, I can use word processors and all that. Number two, I have the benefit of a massive bibliography that other scholars created. There are 25,000 items listed in a bibliography, many of them relevant to the study. And number three, I got to start with Baring-Gould. You know, he started with a blank page. So there's a tremendous amount of research. One of the great joys has been to discover how much incredible historical material is available on the internet. Primary source material, newspapers, almanacs, magazines, and of course, scholarly works going back 150, 200 years in some cases. For example, when I was doing Frankenstein, I told my wife when I started it, you know, great news, we're going to go to England and we're going to spend a week or so in Oxford looking at the original manuscript of Frankenstein, because it's at the Bodleian Library at Oxford. And then, son of a gun, they digitized it. So I didn't even have to leave my office. I just could sit here and look at the manuscript on my own computer. It was really maddening. I killed that trip. But, no, I mean, the resources on the internet now are staggering. In addition, there's some surprising resources. I mean, I always tell a story about I was looking for some bit of information and found it on the internet, and it was in a book that was sitting 3 feet from me on my bookshelf. That book didn't have an index, and I didn't know that that bit of information was in there. But Google turned it up.
Yeah.
But I have strange resources. I mean, I have an 1888 Britannica. I have a 1910 Britannica. I have a lot of almanacs and gazetteers and travel guides and the like, and I love using them. They're just great tools. So the latest book that I'm doing is a little more contemporary. It's called Classic American Mysteries of the 1920s. But even the 1920s is almost 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, having to research the cultural history of, in this case, New York, San Francisco, Honolulu, Chicago, of those periods. You know, I'm out sort of running around trying to find city directories and travel guides and the like to find out things. Like, for example, one of the books, there's five novels in that book. The five novels are the first Charlie Chan mystery called The House Without a Key, the first Ellery Queen mystery called The Roman Hat Mystery, the first Dashiell Hammett called Red Harvest, the first gangster novel called Little Caesar, and the first Philo Vance detective novel. Philo Vance was a very, very popular detective of the day.
Yeah.
By S.S. Van Dyne. That one is the Benson murder case. So Van Dyne is in New York, Ellery Queen is in New York, Charlie Chan is in Honolulu and San Francisco, Red Harvest takes place in a slightly fictionalized Butte, Montana. So lots of geographical research. And I mean, things like Ellery Queen, the Roman Hat Mystery, takes place in the theater. So I'm looking at theater seating diagrams from the 1920s, and you know,
yeah,
just strange things.
Well, I would imagine there's so much to encompass here. How do you feel about things? We come across shows and people that have claims and write books on solving crimes and things such as, you know, Jack the Ripper and numerous of them. You know, there's tons.
Right.
And,
well,
and,
I mean, I read some true crime.
Right.
And it's interesting stuff. And, I mean, there's certainly some important books. This is a good time for me to plug a book that I did last year with Laura Caldwell called Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted. Now, that was a sort of true crime anthology in which we put together the stories of 15 people who had been exonerated for crimes that they of which they were completely innocent, but meanwhile had spent years and years in prison. So, I mean, I think from a social justice standpoint, it's important to look at those kinds of studies, those kinds of books, and those are important. But, you know, I'm more of a regular mystery reader as opposed to true crime.
I was just wondering if something comes up, like sometimes history will put on a show from some book, and it'll be, my great-grandfather was Jack the Ripper or
right.
something.
Right.
And they come up with this theory. It's usually always based on one or two concepts. And one of them would be, for instance, the writing of one of the letters of Jack the Ripper used these two phrases. And they were not English phrases. They were American phrases.
Right.
You know, things like that. But how do you look at stuff like that? Because you study this as in to annotate.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, you're right. I look at a lot of text. I think that's valid stuff. I mean, the Sherlockian approach is sound. It's just hard to do because there's so much data and trying to find the relevant data. But no, I mean, I understand that sort of looking at something. Again, I do the same with texts. I'm looking through the texts for clues.
Right. But it has to be more complete is what I'm saying. Like if I was to go out and say, this person killed this person because he used this phrase and it was written in here. But don't we need to have a little bit more complete kind of thought of what else was going on in the world, in that city? Like there's just so much missing to pick that.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, you can't facts never exist in a vacuum. They exist in a social and historical context. And that's exactly what I'm trying to bring out. I mean, you may take a Sherlock Holmes story, for example, in which the character is a typewritist. One of the sort of lesser known and lesser regarded stories called A Case of Identity, about a woman named Mary Sutherland, who seems to be sort of foolish. She's been duped by her stepfather into thinking that he's a new lover, etc. But I find the story fascinating because of her social position. She was a young woman. She had a small inheritance, so she had a slight amount of income from there, but she was a typewritist, which was one of the tiny handful of occupations available to women of that era being roughly 1890. They could be nannies, or they could be typewritists. Typewriting was a great thing. They would own a typewriter. They would type documents in their home for clients. And they could make, according to Mary Sutherland, she says she makes £100 a year. Well, that's a pretty small amount of income, but it was enough for her to live. That's like $500 U.S. at the time. So I think there's a lot to be appreciated, gathered from these small clues about the social milieu and what life was really like. And can it be used in a situation of crime solving? Of course.
So now I noticed also that one of your last books there, just in November, was called Echoes of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, so those are a little different. So.
Yeah, I was going to say they're a little different. So what's going on with that book?
Okay, well, so I've done two different kinds of anthologies in addition to these annotated books. One of them is a series that my friend Laurie King and I came up with, and we have a fourth volume. Glad you asked. We have a fourth one coming out in December. And the idea was this. Once upon a time, we were at a mystery convention together, and Laurie is the author. I don't know if you've had her on the show. Laurie is the author of the Mary Russell series, a very, very successful series of mystery novels involving a young woman who at the age of 15 meets the retired Sherlock Holmes. He's in his 50s. He takes her under his wing. He trains her, and eventually he marries her, but at a decent age, when she turns 21. And the books are really about her, but Holmes is an important character. So Laurie and I always end up doing Sherlock Holmes-related panels at the mystery conventions. Well, this particular year, the organizers said, who would you like on your panel? And I said, Michael Connelly, Lee Child, and Jan Burke, who I knew were at the convention. And they said, well, those are our guests of honor. We don't do that. And I said, well, no, this is going to be an unusual panel. I happen to know that they are all secretly fans of Sherlock Holmes. And let's do a Sherlock Holmes panel, and it'll be great. And we did the panel, and, of course, those guys sat there on the panel, and they said, they would say, well, I don't really know very much about Sherlock Holmes, but, and then they would come out with these wonderful, insightful remarks about whatever the question was about Sherlock Holmes and mysteries and all that. So after the panel, I said to Lori, I wonder if those people would write something for us if we put together an anthology. People who are sort of not known as Sherlockians. So we started going to our friends in the mystery world, every one of them an A-list writer, and said to them, I know that you love Sherlock Holmes. Would you write us a story inspired by Sherlock Holmes? We're not asking you to write a Sherlock Holmes story. We're asking you to write a story that comes out of your experience of having read the Sherlock Holmes stories. So some of the stories in these, and there's three anthologies so far. The first one is called A Study in Sherlock. The second is called In the Company of Sherlock Holmes. And that one won the Anthony and Silver Falchion for Best Anthology. And the stories are by people like Lee Child, Jeff Deaver, Michael Connelly, Sarah Paretsky, etc. Major names in the mystery world. Many of them American, not all. Some we have Denise Mina from Scotland. We have my friend Michael Stewart from Ireland, and so on. And some of them are not even mystery writers. I mean, we went to people who are known for writing in Neil Gaiman wrote a story for us, for example. And in this next collection, we have Weston Oakes, a well-known horror writer. Cornelia Funke wrote a story for us in one of the collections. They all come from their love of Sherlock Holmes. And some of them are stories about detectives that when you read them, you say, wow, it's Holmes and Watson. Some of them are stories about minor characters in some of the Sherlock Holmes stories. Some of them are about fans of Sherlock Holmes. And so on. And they're just delightful. It's been so much fun to do this series. So we have four anthologies like that. The fourth one is called For the Sake of the Game, and it comes out in December from Pegasus Books.
You know, I just wonder, you've got a lot of Sherlock Holmes, and then I see Dracula as well. Is there certain things that lead you to certain books?
Well, I'm a geek.
Well,
yeah, I'm a geek at heart. Well, and not just Dracula. I mean, H.P. Lovecraft, Frankenstein, certainly not a mystery, and Watchmen and Sandman. Both of you know, those are graphic novels which have nothing to do. Well, I always say Watchmen is a murder mystery, but yeah, I mean, I am interested in books that have passionate audiences. Dracula is one of them. Frankenstein is one of them. Lovecraft is one of them. Because the passionate audiences, first of all, they respond to my appreciation of those books. And it is nice to sell books. I mean, I've pitched the idea of annotating books that Norton and others have said, nobody's going to buy that book, Les. Yes, we agree, it's an interesting book, but there's no audience for it. So I try and pick books where there's going to be an audience. People are going to actually read it and appreciate careful attention to one of their favorite books. And I'm a geek myself. As I said, I started out in the science fiction field. I love graphic novels. And so, yeah, my tastes are certainly much broader than the mystery world. But, I'm really happy to be going back to the mysteries now with this 1920s collection. And my hope is that it'll do well enough that we'll do the 1930s and the 40s and the 50s and so on.
Oh, I bet it will. I'd be surprised if it didn't. There's so much, you know, the true crime and the whole, that whole genre is just so popular now in so many ways that I think it fits. I think it's a great time, too. It's a great era.
I mean, it's so interesting to do this stuff. When I was doing Watchmen, for example, do you know Watchmen?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so it's set in, I mean, it's an alternate universe. It's set in 1986. And in this alternate universe, don't be too frightened by what I'm going to say. Richard Nixon is still in office. He's in his fourth term as president. He's gotten the Constitution amended. And we're on the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. At the same time, it turns out there's an actual superhero in the world, Captain Dr. Metropolis, who is the byproduct of an atomic accident. And Moore says that what he wanted to explore was how the world would have been different, would have changed, if in fact there was a real superhero in the world, and in this case, an American superhero. So, for example, we win the Vietnam War handily because Dr. Metropolis helps the U.S. Armed Forces. But what I was going to point out is then writing this book, I had to go back and lay out for the contemporary reader the history of the Vietnam War, the history of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford and the Soviet Union, because these are already lost. It was 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was more than 30 years ago that we were in Vietnam. And I know that a lot of readers just don't remember that stuff anymore, or have suppressed it, or
oh,
never learned.
That's true. No, it's too far gone.
Yeah.
We have a lot of listeners that are 30, 35.
Exactly.
It's not the same just being told about it, you know, and not living it. It's just...
That's right. That's right. So it's really, I mean, you know, the idea now that it's, so we laugh about this, we writers laugh about this, that the category of, quote, historical mystery now encompasses books that cover periods prior to 1950,
yeah.
You know.
it's got your life in it.
exactly. But it's been fascinating to study those time periods because you look at them in a different way than when you were living through them.
Well, yeah, looking back, and now you have lived longer, you've learned more, and you look
right,
back
you
at it differently. Plus, there's not the same tension, like when you're there
exactly.
And it's happening, right? So,
well, and also there's presumably some objective histories that have been written about those periods, too. So that it isn't just trying to read the newspapers and,
yeah.
You know, trying to make sense of
the headline. Then how do you deal with something like that? Because in the Trump world now, and where, you know, InfoWars is the big national news agency, how is it that what we're told is true? Like, you know what I'm saying? I know there's just so
yes.
much anti... it's just all liberal or whatever. There's some sort of bad word associated
right. Well, it's
with...
just biased. It's just biased. I mean, it's just, you know, it may be biased toward the point of view that you agree with, or it may be biased away from the point of view you agree with, but a lot of the stuff that's on the Internet, which is our news, is biased. It's very hard to find objective reporting.
Well, but it changes the story to the fact of, okay, so we've learned some of the basics about the Second World War and
right.
dropping the bomb and all this stuff. And then you get, and now there's a whole narrative, and there's books out that the president knew they were going to that Hawaii was going to get bombed, and you've got all these, you know, very complex histories written now by groups that have a substantial following and
yes.
a belief in society, like a, you know, it's a pretty decent percentage, and I just don't. That sort of terrifies me a little bit. I mean, sure, there's always bias. As U.S. is going to write about, well, we won the war, and it's going to be that side,
right? And you still have to sort it out. I mean, right. and when you go back, by the way, if you go back, let me give you, for instance, the first Sherlock Holmes novel, you may know, is called A Study in Scarlet, and it's in large part about the Mormons. Now, the Mormons were a subject of intense interest in Victorian London in the late 19th century. And there was a great deal of coverage of things in the press. And there was a number of books about, oh, those evil white slavers and all that. I mean, my point being, they were absorbing contemporarily the same kind of distorted investigative reporting / journalism that we do today about things, about that subject. And when you go back and you try and sort through now from the perspective of 100 years later what was really going on, there is still controversy because the church has been secretive about things. But at least we get a little more balance. We can see a little more objectively, yes, there were bad things. Yes, there were good things. I just finished reading, and if you haven't read it, I really recommend reading Mark Twain's autobiography. It's enormous, you know, it's like 3,000 pages long. But the reason it's relevant to this conversation is because he put down a stricture that it couldn't be published for 100 years. And he said he did that because he wanted to be able to tell the truth. He wanted to be able to express his views about people and historical events with no danger that he was going to hurt feelings, you know, get sued for libel, those kinds of things. So, for example, he hated Teddy Roosevelt and goes on and on and on about Roosevelt. And it's interesting to read that now without the heat of the day, you know, when we can look back and sort out the evidence and say, was he right? Was he wrong? With maybe some more objectivity. And, you know, it comes out of this literature, too. It certainly comes out of this literature. So it's a great deal. I love annotating because I just learn so many things all the time.
Yeah, I guess it's like anything. It's constant change, and it's just kind of I just find it amazing. And I think I just don't know where it's going to go.
Well, I hope forward.
Yeah, we'll I hope so, too. You know, we've got to...
And then, you know, and this is, I mean, one of the things that I take great joy out of, too, is that this is, I'm writing about books. I love books. And, you know, it's my joy to write about books and to maybe get other people excited about books.
Well, you know, and especially in the world today where so many people can have easier access to publishing their own book and
right.
and getting it out there. And I think it opens it up to more, just to more people, you know, everybody can get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of things have you got planned next? Like where are you heading now?
Well, I'm about to sign a deal. I can't tell you the title because we haven't actually signed a deal yet. But I'm about to undertake annotating a major fantasy novel. That's going to be a lot of fun. It's one that I love, and I've wanted to do it for a long time. So that's in the works. There are a second volume of my annotated H.P. Lovecraft comes out next year. We were, for reasons of sort of trying to keep the book affordable, we only put 22 stories in the first volume, and it still turned out to be 900 pages. There's another 25 stories that are going to be in a second volume that comes out from Norton, I think, October of next year. And as I said, this classic American crime writing, that comes out in October of this year. So that's what's coming down the pike.
Boy, you're just not stopping, are you?
Well, you know, I figure I've only got another 20, 30 years.
Oh, God.
So I got to get busy.
Jeez, I tell myself I've got 10. And
well, I'm being facetious. I wish I have another 20, 30 years. We'll see. I'm sorry I waited until I got to this stage of my life to start.
Yeah.
I wish I had started writing 20 years earlier. But now I love doing it. And the reception of the readers has been so positive that I just want to keep going.
Yeah, yeah, I can relate to that myself. So, who are your favorite writers?
Today? Contemporary writers?
Yeah.
Well, so I do love mysteries. I read Bob Crace's books. I read Michael Connelly's books. That's probably my main two mystery writers. And then I still read a great deal of science fiction and fantasy. I just finished the first volume of the new Philip Pullman trilogy, called The Book of Dust, which I loved. What else am I reading? I read all kinds of things. I'm reading A Legacy of Spies by John le Carré. My dear friend Neil Gaiman, I love everything he writes. So I read pretty eclectically. I always look at, you know, who won the Nebula or Hugo Awards in the science fiction field, try and read those books. I read fantasy, science fiction, and mysteries. And once in a while, for recreation, I might read some mainstream literature. I loved A Gentleman in Moscow. I thought that was a great book.
Yeah.
I do so much reading for research that I don't really take the time to read biography, you know, current history books and things like that.
Right.
Shame on me. But
shame.
I just, you know, there's a limit. And I must say, by the way, I have almost an hour drive each way to and from the office. So probably 90% of my reading now is audio. And I love that.
Yeah.
I love audio.
I do too, actually. I'd hate to admit it, but it's true. I do so many audio books. It's just crazy. All at night, I listen to them with my dog and then and driving.
Great.
And doing everything.
Great.
I just love it. Well, you know, like that, the eyes are going, you know?
Well, that's, yeah, I understand.
You know,
so,
it's straining to read. I had both cataracts.
Exactly.
Surgery and...
oh, well, that's too bad.
You know, it's... But now they've got audio.
Audio's great. Yep, it's great, so...
And that's fantastic. Well, I'll tell you.
All right.
It's certainly been interesting. I just love...
Yeah.
History and this sort of information, and I think that we'll hear, but I'm sure the listeners they're just going to love this. So
thank you for
taking the time. And
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. I love talking about these books, and great to be on your show.
Harvey, want anything special for your birthday?
Just a decent cup of coffee.
You're kidding.
I'm serious. Honey, your coffee's undrinkable.
Pretty harsh.
Well, so's your coffee. You know, the girls down at the office make better coffee on their hot plates. Well, see you later.
And he didn't even kiss me goodbye. You know, if I could just make a decent cup of coffee, I could relax. So, relax. Why don't you try Instant Folgers? Tastes good as fresh perked. Good as fresh perked. I'll surprise Harvey for his birthday tonight.
Hey, great coffee.
It's Instant Folgers. Doesn't it taste good as fresh perked?
Better.
Better than those girls make at the office.
Honey, their coffee can't hold a candle to yours.
Instant Folgers taste good as fresh perked. Try it.
You're listening to The House of Mystery. And now, back to the show.
I'm Nancy Grace, and I'm on the House of Mystery.
Okay, and we're back, and it's Easter weekend is over. And, of course, Kevin's with me, and let's see. We've got Joe on the line here. He's just ready to give us our after Easter countdown. How you doing, Joe?
Very good. Happy Easter to everyone. He is risen.
He is. Well, okay. Good. So what happened during the rising?
Well, it was a quiet weekend for me, but apparently Easter was very busy in the conspiracy world, so I should have said the conspiracy theorists have risen.
Don't we always? Can't keep a good man down.
So I have a very interesting top three for the week, and I'll get right into it. So number three is actually true, but then the conspiracy theorists have taken it a little bit further. A NASA-backed study says that acid clouds on Venus, which are at 500 degrees Celsius, so very hot, may contain actual life forms. And what NASA was referring to was potential microbes living in these acid clouds. What conspiracy theorists say is that NASA is hiding the true life forms, which are alien civilizations living in these acid clouds.
So there are, okay, let me make sure I got this straight. There are actual beings, physical beings living in acid.
Well, it sounds like 1968, right? But it's
yes.
Not. This is a different planet. This is the planet Venus. And they're saying microbes. So it's very small life forms could be there. That's what NASA says. But the conspiracy theorists say, no, NASA's trying to hide the alien civilization in the acid cloud.
The domed cities.
Well, it reminds me of a Star Trek episode where they have the city in the cloud up above the, you know, they have the people working in the mines. If you remember that episode.
Absolutely.
So, all right, so that's number three for the week. That just gets us started. Number two, a little more interesting, and it's a riff off of Pizzagate that seems to still be ruminating out there, and it was sparked by Roseanne. As you know, Roseanne had a very popular TV show that just got brought back, and I think she had something like 20 or 30 million viewers for the
episode.
So Roseanne tweeted out support for Donald Trump, and she seems to believe that Donald Trump has been breaking up sex rings or pedophilia rings out there. So she thinks that Trump has been giving a bad rap, and she says that Trump has been breaking up these sex rings and provided some links as evidence of this. And the conspiracy theory is called The Storm. which refers back to a Donald Trump speech that he gave a month back where he said this is just the beginning of a storm, and people hypothesized that he was referring to breaking up the Democratic pedophile rings.
Well, he had some help from a storm, per se.
But I don't know. Maybe I lost it. Maybe I'm not thinking here. So why would Roseanne bring that up? Like, what's the tie here?
Well, that's what has everybody questioning, and I'm sure on our top three list next week we'll have some reasons why that might be. But for now, her character on the show seems to be a Trump supporter. But also, Roseanne herself, she has tweets out that seem to be favorable towards Donald Trump, which don't make a lot of sense if you consider that she is an avowed socialist.
Mm.
But I think what's going on here is that Roseanne isn't so much about socialism, it's just she has an outsider view of politics, and I think that has sort of bent her in Donald Trump's direction. So she seems to be a lot more favorable of him than other more mainstream Hollywood types.
Well, how about this, Joe? This is just a thought, since we're all just sitting here talking, that maybe it's because she is a Hollywood insider and she's sick of the garbage that's going on that, you know, we talk about and we make fun of and, you know, we make into conspiracies, but maybe she's just sick of it and has thrown her support in a different direction.
Well, that could be true. It's just the one part where that goes off the rails is that the evidence she has that Trump is breaking up these child sex rings is they aren't really child sex rings. They're doing a lot of stings with prostitution. And the vast majority of people that they bust are prostitutes and johns and pimps, but not the child trafficking or the pedophilia rings that are hypothesized about, you know, on the Reddit forums.
Yeah, it's just strange. I don't see her jumping on a bandwagon for him or for the opposition for any reason, because, you know, in these climates, you can ruin your free, you know, who's going to watch your show?
I will. Well, and I don't even like Roseanne.
You see, but that's just what I'm saying. It's so, you know.
Well, the question is, would she be voicing support for Donald Trump if she wasn't playing a pro-Trump character on TV and if the show wasn't already doing well? I mean, those are sort of interesting questions.
Is she a method actor?
I think that's the right question to ask.
Well, there we go. I feel better.
Number one.
And number one goes back to the girther conspiracy theory. This week.
I like good girth.
Yeah, yeah. I'm taking this personal.
This past week, Jim Messina, who is a former official in the Obama administration, has cited with a new form of the girther conspiracy theory. And if you remember, the girther conspiracy theory was that the doctor of President Trump lied about his weight and height and health condition in order to make the president look more healthy and fit than he actually was. Well, the new part of that conspiracy theory is that that doctor, Dr. Ronnie Johnson, has been nominated to run the VA. And people are saying that the doctor must have lied about Trump's health in exchange for a position running the VA. So that's our conspiracy, number one conspiracy theory this week.
Wow.
I can't even say that I oppose that theory.
Sounds very real, right?
Hey, I hope that doctor is still in charge for my last year, you know, with the National Guard so that I can make my retirement.
Yeah, you'll be in great
shape. If he's willing to lie about my weight, heck yeah, I'm like 6'2 and a healthy 175.
Healthiest man alive.
Yes, until I reach retirement.
Well, you can be whatever height and weight you want as long as you do your show on the radio.
Exactly. You know?
True. And get Roseanne to back us. We're good.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes back to the idea that somehow we expect politicians to be appointed to positions based on their virtues and not based on some sort of inside horse trading. Mm. You know, and why would we be shocked that Trump or any president would appoint somebody who did them a favor, if indeed that was the case?
And why is that so unusual?
It's not. It's just with today's media that I will say is incredibly anti-Trump, that he can't do anything without it being part of some conspiracy. So,
hey, but it keeps us in business, right?
It keeps the checks rolling in.
Now, speaking of conspiracy, ask Al. I have been waiting a couple, 3 weeks to ask you about this, Joe. I happened upon a conspiracy. It's not a new one, but it's one that I really think deserves a second look, and it is this, that each one of us with a social security number has an account that exists within the Federal Reserve, and that if we have knowledge of said account, we can actually access that account to use to, you know, because we, as a citizen with this number, we have a monetary value. Have you heard of this one before?
Yeah, so this is fairly popular, and so there's a couple different strands of this, and some of it goes back to when we went off the gold standard. And some people say that you have an account with money in it. Some people say you have an account with gold in it.
Oh, boy.
Some people say that Nixon leveraged our lives when we came off the gold standard. Other people think that we have... that we're somehow separate from the government and not subject to any laws, as long as we know about this secret thing that you're talking about. So I've been actually contacted by prosecutors and by defense lawyers to have me come in and testify on cases about this, where people either have not paid their taxes or they've gotten arrested for something and they're going to claim that they're part of this redemption movement or something like this.
Oh, like sovereign citizenry.
Yeah, sovereign citizens. So a lot of this is very similar. But anyway, the people always go to jail, and they never get money. So it could be true. Well, it's just that it doesn't seem to work out in court in anyone's favor.
Well, let me cross that off my list, and damn. No, but I'd really like to explore this a little bit further with you in our next conspiracy roundup.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about that. I do want to get this in before we go, though. I received a phone call on the drive-in, and unfortunately I had to hang up on the poor woman, but this is not an invitation for her to call me back. But she said that her ex-husband had joined the Illuminati and was out to get her. And normally I tell people to either call the police or to get some other form of help. And I would have told her that, but I was driving through heavy traffic. But emails are kind of better for me to deal with this sort of stuff than the phone calls.
Well, Al, isn't she scheduled for an interview here in a couple days?
Actually, yeah, she comes on at noon today. That's Alex Jones' ex-wife is on the show.
Oh.
So she may have been...
Well, if you thought divorce was costly, just imagine if you got divorced and then that person became an Illuminati overlord.
Oh, my.
I mean, just have that hanging over your head.
Yeah. Well, you see, this is where you need a good agent. That agent would have told her. When she phoned you and said to her husband, you'd say, well, speak to my agent.
Easy. Easy done.
Well, Joe, thanks again. Awesome.
Thank you. I'll see you guys next week.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, guys.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.